Support for the Media Project comes from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a Master of Arts in Communications to advance careers in media, PR, and journalism. Fuller part-time options, 518-454-5143. And Rosenbaum Media Group, a digital communications agency integrating high-definition video into PR, marketing, advertising, and social media campaigns. Big-picture thinking for local and national clients. RosenbaumMedia.com. From Northeast Public Radio, this is The Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
So thanks, Pete. We appreciate the music always, and we're glad to be back at the Media Project. Welcome, folks. I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union, here with Ira Fussfeld, longtime publisher of the Daily Freeman in Kingston.
Good day. Good to be back.
Absolutely. Back from visiting grandchild.
Visiting grandson in California, where it was nice and warm for 2 weeks, and I thought I'd get back in time for the spring here, but no such luck.
Not yet.
No.
Dr. Alan Chartok, CEO of Northeast Public Radio, he who puts up with the cold weather on his morning commute in the middle of the night from the Berkshires to Albany. How's it going, Alan?
Well, you know, when you get up at 2:30 in the morning, by the time you get to, you know, like now, we record this around 8 o'clock in the morning, that's half your day.
Yeah. Well, then
I thought I mentioned that.
That's very good. You it's time for your midday nap then. You know, go right ahead. If you just want to drift off here, Ira and I will take it over.
But as long as we're speaking about things that are impressive, Rex, I'm so impressed with your sartorial splendor.
My.
Yeah, you wear very expensive suits. You wear a fedora hat. You know, you really are a model for what a newspaper executive ought to look like. Things that our fathers may have dressed like, but that we don't anymore.
And he can pull it off. And people of a certain age might remember the ads that used to appear in Playboy that said, "What kind of man reads Playboy?" And it was usually someone very dapper like Rex. It was a middle-aged guy dressed very well. I mean, Rex would have worked well in those ads.
I was too young to read Playboy in those days,
well,
however.
I was so young that I read them for the pictures, not for the stories.
There you go. Absolutely. Speaking of old brands, we need to speak here about the P word. The P word not being Playboy, the P word being print. Amazingly enough, Newsweek is coming back into print. It was owned by the Graham family, the Washington Post company.
Magazine, yeah.
They sold Newsweek for a buck.
Yeah.
Not a copy of Newsweek. They sold the whole company for a dollar. And Barry Diller put some tens of millions of dollars into it, trying to revive it. He gave up on it. Tina Brown couldn't bring it back. You know, she had Daily Beast. Newsweek was the combined brand that she put together to make a digital print presence. But there's this little digital publishing company. One guy's 31, the other one's 30, IBT Media. And they think they can recreate Newsweek as a web-only magazine, but they plan to turn the printing presses again, and hard copies are out. So Newsweek is back from the dead. Kind of interesting.
Well, we don't know how long it's back from the dead. We know that others have tried it and it died again.
Right.
So it might happen again here. It seems to me that the way we're going is almost inevitable. You know, unless you put somebody into a magazine where you have something in the upper left-hand corner which says, "New ways to have sex," I don't know how you can sell these things.
Well, they're not exactly jumping off
a
cliff.
How to please your man.
They're not exactly jumping off a cliff because they're only printing 70,000 copies, which is a lot of copies for small publishers, but not a lot of copies as compared to Newsweek at its height when it was selling in the millions. So, you know, if they can figure out a business plan to sell 70,000 copies at $8 a copy, that's a relatively small number to sell and a nice piece of revenue if they can attain it. But I'm presuming that their expense is not great. And it still says that the future is digital, but because they're not making a deep plunge here.
There may be something political about all of this, if you think about it. You know, in the old days, Time magazine was often parodied by many of the people I ran with as being reactionary, if not worse, as a magazine, the Luces and all the rest. And along comes Newsweek, and, you know, it becomes a more progressive Washington Post-y sort of place. Or as Arlo once said, you can't have dark unless you have some light to put into it. And so I'm thinking that it may be reflective of the times, contemporary times as opposed to the New York Times, of the times that we don't have this sort of, you know, yearning to have a progressive, or if not progressive, moderate voice on the left. Do you think that's possible?
Well, I think it has more to do with just the decline of print in general. I mean, look, the magazine world, even though there's still demand, as you say, for a certain kind of magazine.
Well, there's still Time magazine.
Not much. There's not much of Time magazine. It is a shell of what it once was, both in terms of the content and the circulation.
Not a bad idea.
Overall, newsstand sales of consumer magazines fell 11% in the second half of last year, 2013, from a year earlier. Really? So you keep having 11% annual declines, and that includes even the great success stories, the magazines that launch and do well. There's an awful lot of downside. But, you know, if you're principally a digital presence and you put out a magazine that gets its cover posted onto a TV show or something like that, hey, here's Newsweek, that's
here's
a great
the man
promotion.
Of the year or whatever.
Yeah, I just think that this is designed for people who have not gotten into the digital revolution, that is to say, senior citizens, and there are many who either don't have computers or just are so tradition-bound that they like to pick up a product in print. And, you know, we see that in the newspaper world. We'll get a complaint sometimes about something that was not in the print edition, and we say, well, no, we had it in the digital edition. Oh, well, I don't own a computer. There are still people, fewer and fewer. And I just think Newsweek may have said there's a market here for 70,000 people in this vast world of ours who would still buy a print publication.
But I would point out that your very keen insight here, Ira, was to say fewer and fewer. And every year there'll be fewer and fewer because as a 72-year-old, I know that I'll go on forever. But there are others who won't.
Yeah, I mean, there was one of the executives, the editorial digital gurus in our company, Digital First Media, put out a blog the other day where his first sentence was, in effect, we all know print is dying. We just don't know when it's going to die. And it's going to be and has been a slow and painful death.
One of the things that is hardest for me to deal with is the mail that comes to my desk from disappointed readers.
What's his name?
Who said?
Sorry.
People who say, you know, I know that you're doing all this stuff online, but that isn't the real Times Union, you know, and you need to give me more. And, you know, one thing is they object to the advertising. Why is there so much advertising in the paper?
Gosh.
Well, gee, I think it's great that there's advertising in the paper, please. I mean, that is, after all, what supports us. And yet for me to deal with the readers who have not made that move to digital at all is just a little difficult. I hate to disappoint people. I'd love to be able to give them everything.
Well, even here at Public Radio, we have that. It was extraordinarily expensive to put out a monthly program guide. So we just went digital, and it saved us a lot of money, really a lot of money, so that we could do what we do. Well, just as in your case, Rex, we got a lot of complaints, and we said, okay, we're going to just sort of, well, it's the right word, rexograph. No, they don't have rexographs anymore. We're going to just, make some copies and send them to people from the digital thing, and it worked.
The first newspaper I was the editor of was printed on a hectograph. Remember hectograph?
I don't. I remember rexographs. I remember.
Really? Yeah. Hectograph was a gel and a particular kind of pencil or typewriter ribbon. You could make about 10 copies, and I was the editor of the Maywood Roundup, which was the newspaper of my neighborhood in Danville. And yes, I was the editor and I went door to door and I think I sold subscriptions for a dime.
Isn't that interesting? Because, you know, Rex, we have different upbringings, as you know, but I went to Beth Hayeled Nursery School in New York on 100th Street in Temple and Chehalis. And I have to tell you that we had one of those gel things to put out on the paper, too. Yeah. So there it all comes together.
I was much less high tech than that. I started my own little newspaper in junior high school. Don't remember what I called it, but it was handwritten and we just passed it around. And the only other thing I remember about it, there used to be a cartoon strip called Mr. Mum. And the only thing that I could draw was the head of Mr. Mum. And our slogan was Mum the word.
So, that's god awful.
And we didn't use gel. We used the number 2 pencil.
That wasn't a good story.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, that was pretty bad.
Sure, because it wasn't yours.
In the aftermath of the Oscars, In the aftermath of the Oscars, of course, John Travolta did this terrible job trying to say the name of Adele Dazeem.
That was the name he did use.
Adele, right, right.
Yes. He said
Adele Dazeem.
Yeah. As opposed to?
Idina Menzel.
Yeah.
And so he sort of
backed it out. Adele Dazeem. How does Adele Dazeem come out of Idina Menzel? It's
very strange. You get nervous.
The most viewed article in Slate's 18-year history was a piece on Travoltifying your name. And they took names and gave them, if you put it through this little blender that they, a digital blender they created, it came out with names. Yours, Ira, what'd yours turn out to be?
Issa Farsta.
Issa Farsta. I know WAMC's Paul Tuthill came out as Paige Turner. That's a good name, you know, Paige Turner. How wonderful.
By the way, that does go on, you know, on our cell phones, where they try to anticipate what the word you meant was.
Oh, sure.
And they put that word down, and it has nothing to do with what you wanted.
That's my great frustration with Apple technology, yeah. The interesting thing about this is that's just for fun. That's a game. But, you know, I'm amazed at how many people fall for these online gimmicks, these digital come-ons. And you can't blame the companies because there's revenue in it, so maybe I should be paying attention. But these are these gimmicks of fill in the blank about who you are, and this will tell us what's your real state, or what beverage would you be, or what kind of plant would you be. And you know what this is. This is data collection. They're collecting all this information about you that they can then sell.
Sure.
To other people. And I'm amazed at how
Well, you know, the New York Times wrote about this, and the angle that they took was that news organizations are increasingly resorting to these kinds of gimmicks, interactive gimmicks, to generate clicks and page views, and as I've said a number of times in the program, to attract eyeballs so you can sell advertising, because look at all the eyeballs we have. But they made a point here that it was the first time that I had made the connection. They were trying to say this is a new phenomenon, this interactivity and bringing those kinds of gimmicks to bring people into the newspapers or whatever your sites are. But as they point out, newspapers in particular have had puzzles and games and non-news methods to try to sell newspapers. And essentially, this is what this is. It's been perfected because it's easier to get interactivity and back and forth. But the phenomenon, in effect, is not new.
No, I think it goes a step beyond. The New York Times created the Times crossword in 1942, yes, to sell newspapers.
Wow, is that right? In 1942?
Yes, there's a little-known fact for the day. There you go. That's what you get, Alan, when you do some research before you do
the article. I
think anybody can prepare. I don't like that. But that means that I'm 1 year older than the New York Times crossword person.
Really? Yeah. And still going strong, both of you.
Without question.
How about that?
And I'm going to live forever.
I have a feeling that the New York Times was not the first. I think crosswords and newspapers predated.
Yeah, absolutely. But what's different is not just that using games and this kind of thing to sell the papers, but then to make it a separate revenue stream. You know, the real purpose of this is not to sell Gawker or BuzzFeed or whatever it is, but it's to then be able to sell the data you collect about individuals, and people don't realize the privacy that they're sacrificing by filling out this stuff and in effect allowing third parties to buy that data then. Maybe we should be glad about this because then it generates funds that can be useful for the site, but that's different from something like ProPublica, the wonderful investigative site, created something called Dollars for Docs. It's an app that allows users to find out if their doctor has taken money from pharmaceutical companies, and that's generated 7 million views since it was first posted in 2010.
Wow.
So that's really kind of an amazing thing. It is newsworthy. It's interesting. And it's kind of smart, you know? So that's a good thing. And we're always trying to come up with, if we can dream up stuff like that, it's a good thing. But
sure. Well, no wonder I get 1,000 emails a day. And I mean 1,000 emails a day.
1,000?
1,000. You know, I mean, I have to admit, I get everything that comes into WMC, to the news division, to the engineering division, rest of that, as the head of the company. But 1,000 a day.
That's a lot.
I just keep my hand on the delete button.
You know, I stopped checking my spam filter about 3 months ago. I just stopped because every morning I would go in and look at the stuff that had been blocked just to make sure that I hadn't lost anything I wanted in the spam filter. And I finally just gave up on it. It was taking up too much time to check. So
I've
never
done it.
That the spam filter stopped.
You're just such a goody two-shoes.
with dressing well.
Our company changed to make Gmail the host of our company mail, and it separates from what is called primary mail to social mail to promotional mail, and it essentially is separating the spam for us. So you can go forever and not have to see
it. Do you have to pay for that?
I don't know how they did. I don't think Gmail has cost anything.
It doesn't cost anything to individuals.
Yeah, I honestly don't know how that works.
I'm not sure about that. Speaking of the Oscars, by the way, there's an unfortunate headline that we just ought to make note
of. Oscar Pretorius.
That's a different Oscar indeed. The Daily Breeze, a newspaper out in Torrance, California, had the headline about 12 Years a Slave winning Best Picture was Slave Becomes Master, which the executive editor of the group calls it tacky, ridiculous, and stupid. That's what the editor of the...
Well, not only was it in the Daily Breeze, it was also in the Los Angeles Daily News, and I suspect any of the other, what we call Lang papers, Los Angeles News Group, which is part of our company, Digital First Media. And I suspect, beyond the fact that it wasn't a terribly good headline, that it was another example of a Sunday night staff writing a headline that didn't have more oversight than...
You know, that's got to be very tough for you guys. I mean, I remember some newspaper, after our phone drive, some newspaper said, you can turn your radio back in the first paragraph. Mm-hmm. And the editor, who I know, got very angry with them. You can turn your radio back on. Their fun drive is over. Oh.
It was up for an hour on the website, maybe an hour, maybe 30 minutes on the website. It's not that the newspaper published it, but it was on the website ever so briefly. And, you know, actually, studies show that people care more about news being done quickly than being done accurately on the web. So we gave people the immediate word that the fun drive was over. Now, you should be grateful for that.
Yeah,
see,
the fun drive is over. The fun drive is over. You can turn your radios back on. Nice. Well, I wasn't going to mention it with you.
Well, I don't want to be overly defensive of my sister newspaper here, but I just have always found that writing good, creative, interesting headlines is about as tough a job as there is in the business, particularly your lead headline, the one that you want to attract attention.
Yeah.
And there is a sense, particularly these days, but maybe always, to try to be clever. I mean, everybody knew by the time the paper was on the newsstand who won that Oscar. So you have to report it in such a way that it attracts attention. And this one just did not work. Inappropriate, I think, to say the least.
So when I was in high school and trying to figure out those headlines, you know, you had to get the right kind of words. You had to do it the right way, and you had to get the right spacing.
Has to fit.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Has to fit.
In the old days, before a computer, we used to write the headline, and then we would send it to the composing room where it was composed in hot type. And if the headline was too long, they literally couldn't squeeze it. So they would send the paper back downstairs, and they'd press a buzzer to let us know that we had written another long headline until we fixed it. But,
I
am old.
Kerning is what's called, is squeezing the letters together. And you can do it to a certain extent. You can kern a little bit. You know, we have standards now.
Is that kern or turn?
K-E-R-N, kern.
Yeah.
And now, actually, our computers, we have an allowable kern that we have decided as part of our style of what is allowed. And the computer really will reject a headline, but you can do it just a little bit.
But where does kern, the word kern, come from?
I don't know the etymological origin.
But in the old days, if you were going to...
Etymological would be about bugs,
insects,
wouldn't it?
Yeah, I don't think there are any insects involved.
In the old days, if you were going to write a 60-point headline across the top of the front page, you knew how many characters would fit.
Sure.
So you would write the headline, and then you would literally go 1, 2, 3,
count.
And you would count them.
Oh,
and
sure,
you,
I remember doing
and
it.
You count the number of elements. Like, generally, most caps are 1.5, mm-hmm. An I is a half, a T is a half. So I'm looking here at the words Boston Globe in the headline I'm about to look at. That's 10.5 elements. I mean, I can do this because I've counted headlines so fast that it's a useless skill.
But the point is, it is very difficult to write a headline that's both creative and interesting and accurate
fits.
And fits and do it on deadline.
Well, but your earlier point, Ira, which was unusually pithy, was, you know, that this is a very good thing to worry about, which is who's on the desk on a Sunday night in the middle of the night.
And in the case of many newspapers, including these that in California,
P-I-T-H-Y.
You have a centralized production desk that is what's good for one newspaper or bad for one paper is good or bad for a whole string of papers. So up and down the West Coast, they saw this headline.
If you're just joining us, it's the Media Project from Northeast Public Radio. Rex Smith, Ira Fussfeld, and Alan Shartok. You can join the conversation by sending us email media@wamc.org, and we will take advantage of that to steal your ideas and make topics out of it, or we may actually read your email on
the air. This is interactivity.
Interactivity, that's right.
Crowdsourcing.
They're all doing it now.
They're all doing it. One of the things that they are all doing is paywalls, that is, making people pay for digital content, and the latest move came from the Boston Globe, where the paywall on bostonglobe.com which is their second website, has been replaced with a meter that allows readers 10 free stories in a 30-day period, and after that, then they have to pay.
And what's going on here, Rex? The whole idea is to get you in, right, number one, and then get you to pay.
Yeah.
So if they find that somebody goes to Boston Globe and they say, okay, 10 and you're out, period, 10 and you're out, that's no good because then you give up. So the whole idea is to get you keeping coming back, right?
Exactly. Whereas what they're doing at the Globe is they have a separate website, boston.com, which is designed to just generate traffic and draw people in with lively stuff like
those contests. You've got that. On the Times Union, you give some but not all of your stories.
And increasingly, you will see a difference between what you pay for, which is in the newspaper or in the e-edition or in the iPad edition,
sure,
and what we put on the website. Some of our papers in our company are doing the same thing that the Boston Globe is doing, having two websites. But what the Boston Globe is doing is saying, you know, we're not going to just have a hard paywall. We're basically going to have a pervious.
But correct me if I'm wrong. Boston.com updates its content throughout the day. I don't believe the Boston Globe website per se, the one we're talking about with the paywall, is anything other than a replication of the print edition.
No, I think they update some.
Do
just
they?
Not as much.
Yeah.
And it's not as much about the lively. The breaking news experience is Boston.com, but you'll get some updates, I think. It is more aimed at the journalism than it is at just the fun traffic.
In answer to Alan's question, I think that what this means is that as this pay situation continues to evolve, that more and more companies, you have to pay for something to get in, period. They're going to the meter approach, which seems to be something that is generating revenue, not necessarily turning off readers, and not necessarily significantly reducing traffic.
Well, when you said meter, mm-hmm. I was thinking that instead of having to buy the newspaper forever, I did that with the Wall Street Journal, and now I'm sorry because, frankly, it isn't doing for me what I thought it would. The New York Times is unbelievable. Like, I go 10 times a day.
Mm-hmm.
And they do update, and I pay for it, and I gladly pay for it. But what about the idea of you buy a particular story? In other words, you spend money to buy a story. You can see the headline. You want to buy the story. You got to put a nickel in.
There's been a lot of talk that that would be a valid approach, and there is software that was designed to do that, and people thought that might be useful, and it seems to not have taken off as an idea. About 3 years ago, there was a company led by Steve Brill, the founder of American Lawyer, who was going to make this work, and I stand to be corrected by
Steve Brill.
That seems to be more likely to occur by the story if it's an archive story.
Yes. And we have recently started charging for our archives.
How much story?
We had, I think it's a couple of bucks.
Mm-hmm. Remember Teresa Brewer? Put another nickel in the Nickelodeon. All I want is loving you and music.
I know who's old now?
I do know that. In the Nickelodeon. But I don't remember who Teresa Brewer was. Is she the one who recorded that?
She was the one who recorded that. Cute little person. I think she was on Name That Tune.
You know, I love being with you guys because I'm so rarely the young guy in the room these days. what can you do? What do you know? Speaking of old, the New York Times has corrected a 161-year-old article. You know, it's never too late to make things right. After 12 Years a Slave won Best Picture, the New York Times decided to fix an 1853 account of Solomon Northup's kidnapping. And so this is, I'm sure, a fine idea to make these things. I'm sure that's more
for... I'm sure it had nothing to do with getting some publicity.
Mentions on such widely popular programs as this one, right?
But isn't it great? I think this is a great story. I mean, the fact is, if you have an archive and people are going to be looking up old stories, and the New York Times is a worldwide institution where people will be looking up and trusting what they find, if they made a mistake 100-some-odd years ago and they're willing to make that correction for the record, I think that's good.
Come on. That's an awfully pompous
thing. I think if there was a mistake in the Times Union about Alan Chartok today and the correction was not discovered 100 years from now, you'd want that updated, particularly if it made it look more favorable.
We're going to go back to that 1988 story about you, Alan, and I'm going to go through
pompous
it.
Pompous and pithy.
Say that three times.
Chartok has a lisp. Okay, so we're going to have to go now, folks, with that.
It's been a great program.
Well, it's been okay. So we hope you will come back and join us next week, and we promise we'll do a little bit better. Thanks.
Why would you do that?
It's the Media Project.
Clean and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk. Pull the press, pull the press. Extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspaperman meets such interesting people. It's...